Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 7 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney, Arkansas, February 2008. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 7. A Rose of Womanhood. When he emerged from the spruce wood and entered the orchard, his heart gave a sudden leap, and he felt that the blood rushed madly to his face. She was there, bending over the bed of June lilies in the center of the garden plot. He could only see her profile, virginal and white. He stopped, not wishing to startle her again. When she lifted her head, he expected to see her shrink and flee, but she did not do so. She only grew a little paler and stood motionless, watching him intently. Seeing this, he walked slowly toward her, and when he was so close to her that he could hear the nervous flutter of her breath over her parted, trembling lips, he said very gently, "Do not be afraid of me. I am a friend, and I do not wish to disturb or annoy you in any way." She seemed to hesitate a moment. Then she lifted a little slate that hung at her belt, wrote something on it rapidly, and held it out to him. He read, in a small distinctive handwriting, "I am not afraid of you now. Mother told me that all strange men were very wicked and dangerous, but I do not think you can be. I have thought a great deal about you, and I am sorry I ran away the other night." He realized her entire innocence and simplicity. Looking earnestly into her still troubled eyes, he said, "I would not do you any harm for the world. All men are not wicked, although it is too true that some are so. My name is Eric Marshall, and I am teaching in the Lindsay School. You, I think, are Kilmeny Gordon. I thought your music so very lovely the other evening that I have been wishing ever since that I might hear it again. Won't you play for me?" The vague fear had all gone from her eyes by this time, and suddenly she smiled, a merry, girlish, wholly irresistible smile, which broke through the calm of her face like a gleam of sunlight rippling over a placid sea. Then she wrote, "I am very sorry that I cannot play this evening. I did not bring my violin with me, but I will bring it tomorrow evening and play for you if you would like to hear me. I should like to please you." Again that note of innocent frankness. What a child she was! What a beautiful, ignorant child, utterly unskilled in the art of hiding her feelings. But why should she hide them? They were as pure and beautiful as herself. Eric smiled back at her with equal frankness. "I should like it more than I can say, and I shall be sure to come tomorrow evening if it is fine. But if it is at all damp or unpleasant, you must not come. In that case, another evening will do. And now won't you give me some flowers?" She nodded with another little smile, and began to pick some of the June lilies, carefully selecting the most perfect among them. He watched her lithe, graceful motions with delight. Every movement seemed poetry itself. She looked like a very incarnation of spring, as if all the shimmer of young leaves, and glow of young mornings, and evanescent sweetness of young blossoms in a thousand springs had been embodied in her. When she came to him, radiant, her hands full of the lilies, a couplet from a favorite poem darted into his head. "A blossom vermeil white, that lightly breaks a faded flower sheath, here, by God's rood, is the one made for me." The next moment he was angry with himself for his folly. She was, after all, nothing but a child, and a child set apart from her fellow creatures by her sad defect. He must not let himself think nonsense. "Thank you. These June lilies are the sweetest flowers the spring brings us. Do you know that their real name is the white narcissus?" She looked pleased and interested. "No, I did not know," she wrote. "I have often read of the white narcissus and wondered what it was like. I never thought of it being the same as my dear June lilies. I am glad you told me. I love flowers very much. They are my very good friends." "You couldn't help being friends with the lilies. Like always takes to like," said Eric. "Come and sit down on the old bench, here, where you were sitting that night I frightened you so badly. I could not imagine who or what you were. Sometimes I thought I had dreamed you, only," he added under his breath and unheard by her, "I could never have dreamed anything half so lovely." She sat down beside him on the old bench and looked unshrinkingly in his face. There was no boldness in her glance, nothing but the most perfect, childlike trust and confidence. If there had been any evil in his heart, any skulking thought he was afraid to acknowledge, those eyes must have searched it out and shamed it, but he could meet them unafraid. Then she wrote, "I was very much frightened. You must have thought me very silly, but I had never seen any man except Uncle Thomas and Neil and the egg peddler. And you are different from them. Oh, very, very different. I was afraid to come back here the next evening, and yet, somehow, I wanted to come. I did not want you to think I did not know how to behave. I sent Neil back for my bow in the morning. I could not do without it. I cannot speak, you know. Are you sorry?" "I am very sorry for your sake." "Yes, but what I mean is, would you like me better if I could speak like other people?" "No, it does not make any difference in that way, Kilmeny. By the way, do you mind my calling you Kilmeny?" She looked puzzled and wrote, "What else would you call me? That is my name. Everybody calls me that." "But I am such a stranger to you that perhaps you would wish me to call you Miss Gordon." "Oh, no, I would not like that," she wrote quickly, with a distressed look on her face. "Nobody ever calls me that. It would make me feel as if I were not myself, but somebody else. And you do not seem like a stranger to me. Is there any reason why you should not call me Kilmeny?" "No reason whatever, if you will allow me the privilege. You have a very lovely name, the very name you ought to have." "I am glad you like it. Do you know that I was called after my grandmother, and she was called after a girl in a poem? Aunt Janet has never liked my name, although she liked my grandmother. But I am glad you like both my name and me. I was afraid you would not like me because I cannot speak." "You can speak through your music, Kilmeny." She looked pleased. "How well you understand," she wrote. "Yes, I cannot speak or sing as other people can, but I can make my violin say things for me." "Do you compose your own music?" he asked. But he saw she did not understand him. "I mean, did anyone ever teach you the music you played here that evening?" "Oh, no, it just came as I thought. It has always been that way. When I was very little, Neil taught me to hold the violin and the bow, and the rest all came of itself. My violin once belonged to Neil, but he gave it to me. Neil is very good and kind to me, but I like you better. Tell me about yourself." The wonder of her grew upon him with every passing moment. How lovely she was! What dear little ways and gestures she had, ways and gestures as artless and unstudied as they were effective. And how strangely little her dumbness seemed to matter after all. She wrote so quickly and easily, her eyes and smile gave such expression to her mobile face, that voice was hardly missed. They lingered in the orchard until the long, languid shadows of the trees crept to their feet. It was just after sunset, and the distant hills were purple against the melting saffron of the sky in the west and the crystalline blue of the sky in the south. Eastward, just over the fir woods, were clouds, white and high, heaped like snow mountains, and the westernmost of them shone with a rosy glow as of sunset on an alpine height. The higher worlds of air were still full of light, perfect stainless light, unmarred of earth shadow. But down in the orchard and under the spruces, the light had almost gone, giving place to a green dewy dusk made passionately sweet with the breath of the apple blossoms and mint, and the balsamic odors that rained down upon them from the firs. Eric told her of his life and the life in the great outer world, in which she was girlishly and eagerly interested. She asked him many questions about it, direct and incisive questions which showed that she had already formed decided opinions and views about it. Yet it was plain to be seen that she did not regard it as anything she might ever share herself. Hers was the dispassionate interest with which she might have listened to a tale of the land of faerie, or of some great empire long passed away from earth. Eric discovered that she had read a great deal of poetry and history, and a few books of biography and travel. She did not know what a novel meant, and had never heard of one. Curiously enough, she was well informed regarding politics and current events, from the weekly paper for which her uncle subscribed. "I never read the newspaper while mother was alive," she wrote, "nor any poetry either. She taught me to read and write, and I read the Bible all through many times, and some of the histories. After mother died, Aunt Janet gave me all her books. She had a great many. Most of them had been given to her as prizes when she was a girl at school, and some of them had been given to her by my father. Do you know the story of my father and mother?" Eric nodded. "Yes, Mrs. Williamson told me all about it. She was a friend of your mother." "I am glad you have heard it. It is so sad that I would not like to tell it, but you will understand everything better because you know. I never heard it until just before mother died. Then she told me all. I think she had thought father was to blame for the trouble, but before she died she told me she believed that she had been unjust to him and that he had not known. She said that when people were dying they saw things more clearly, and she saw she had made a mistake about father. She said she had many more things she wanted to tell me, but she did not have time to tell them because she died that night. It was a long while before I had the heart to read her books, but when I did, I thought them so beautiful. They were poetry, and it was like music put into words." "I will bring you some books to read, if you would like them," said Eric. Her great blue eyes gleamed with interest and delight. "Oh, thank you, I would like it very much. I have read mine over so often that I know them nearly all by heart. One cannot get tired of really beautiful things. But sometimes I feel that I would like some new books." "Are you never lonely, Kilmeny?" "Oh no, how could I be? There is always plenty for me to do, helping Aunt Janet about the house. I can do a great many things." She glanced up at him with a pretty pride as her flying pencil traced the words. "I can cook and sew. Aunt Janet says I am a very good housekeeper, and she does not praise people very often or very much. And then, when I am not helping her, I have my dear, dear violin. That is all the company I want. But I like to read and hear of the big world so far away, and the people who live there, and the things that are done. It must be a very wonderful place." "Wouldn't you like to go out into it, and see its wonders, and meet those people yourself?" he asked, smiling at her. At once he saw that, in some way he could not understand, he had hurt her. She snatched her pencil and wrote, with such swiftness of motion and energy of expression, that it almost seemed as if she had passionately exclaimed the words aloud. "No, no, no! I do not want to go anywhere away from home. I do not want ever to see strangers, or have them see me. I could not bear it." He thought that possibly the consciousness of her defect accounted for this. Yet she did not seem sensitive about her dumbness, and made frequent casual references to it in her written remarks. Or perhaps it was the shadow on her birth. Yet she was so innocent that it seemed unlikely she could realize or understand the existence of such a shadow. Eric finally decided that it was merely the rather morbid shrinking of a sensitive child who had been brought up in an unwholesome and unnatural way. At last the lengthening shadows warned him that it was time to go. "You won't forget to come tomorrow evening and play for me," he said, rising reluctantly. She answered by a quick little shake of her sleek, dark head and a smile that was eloquent. He watched her as she walked across the orchard, with the moon's beauty and the moon's soft pace, and along the wild cherry lane. At the corner of the fir she paused and waved her hand to him before turning it. When Eric reached home, old Robert Williamson was having a lunch of bread and milk in the kitchen. He looked up with a friendly grin as Eric strode in, whistling. "Been having a walk, master?" he queried. "Yes," said Eric. Unconsciously and involuntarily, he infused so much triumph into the simple monosyllable that even old Robert felt it. Mrs. Williamson, who was cutting bread at the end of the table, laid down her knife and loaf and looked at the young man with a softly troubled expression in her eyes. She wondered if he had been back to the Connors' orchard, and if he could have seen Kilmeny Gordon again. "You didn't discover a gold mine, I suppose," said old Robert dryly. "You look as if you might have." End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney, Arkansas, February 2008. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 8. At the Gate of Eden. When Eric went to the old Connors orchard the next evening, he found Kilmeny waiting for him on the bench under the white lilac tree, with the violin in her lap. As soon as she saw him, she caught it up and began to play an airy, delicate little melody that sounded like the laughter of daisies. When it was finished, she dropped her bow and looked up at him with flushed cheeks and questioning eyes. "What did that say to you?" she wrote. "It said something like this," answered Eric, falling into her humor smilingly. "Welcome, my friend. It is a very beautiful evening. The sky is so blue and the apple blossoms so sweet. The wind and I have been here alone together, and the wind is a good companion, but still I am glad to see you. It is an evening on which it is good to be alive and to wander in an orchard that is fine and white. Welcome, my friend." She clapped her hands, looking like a pleased child. "You are very quick to understand," she wrote. "That was just what I meant. Of course, I did not think it in just those words, but that was the feeling of it. I felt that I was so glad I was alive, and that the apple blossoms and the white lilacs and the trees and I were all pleased together to see you come. You are quicker than Neil. He is almost always puzzled to understand my music, and I am puzzled to understand his. Sometimes it frightens me. It seems as if there were something in it trying to take hold of me, something I do not like and want to run away from." Somehow Eric did not like her references to Neil. The idea of that handsome, low-born boy seeing Kilmeny every day, talking to her, sitting at the same table with her, dwelling under the same roof, meeting her in the hundred intimacies of daily life, was distasteful to him. He put the thought away from him and flung himself down on the long grass at her feet. "Now play for me, please," he said. "I want to lie here and listen to you." "And look at you," he might have added. He could not tell which was the greater pleasure. Her beauty, more wonderful than any pictured loveliness he had ever seen, delighted him. Every tint and curve and outline of her face was flawless. Her music enthralled him. This child, he told himself as he listened, had genius. But it was being wholly wasted. He found himself thinking resentfully of the people who were her guardians, and who were responsible for her strange life. They had done her a great and irremediable wrong. How dared they doom her to such an existence? If her defect of utterance had been attended to in time, who knew but that it might have been cured? Now it was probably too late. Nature had given her a royal birthright of beauty and talent, but their selfish and unpardonable neglect had made it of no account. What divine music she lured out of the old violin, merry and sad, gay and sorrowful by turns, music such as the stars of morning might have made singing together, music that the fairies might have danced to in their revels among the green hills or on yellow sands, music that might have mourned over the grave of a dead hope. Then she drifted into a still sweeter strain. As he listened to it, he realized that the whole soul and nature of the girl were revealing themselves to him through her music. The beauty and purity of her thoughts, her childhood dreams, and her maiden reveries. There was no thought of concealment about her. She could not help the revelation she was unconscious of making. At last she laid her violin aside and wrote, "I have done my best to give you pleasure. It is your turn now. Do you remember a promise you made to me last night? Have you kept it?" He gave her the two books he had brought for her, a modern novel and a volume of poetry unknown to her. He had hesitated a little over the former, but the book was so fine and full of beauty that he thought it could not bruise the bloom of her innocence ever so slightly. He had no doubts about the poetry. It was the utterance of one of those great inspired souls whose passing tread had made the kingdom of their birth and labor a veritable holy land. He read her some of the poems. Then he talked to her of his college days and friends. The minutes passed very swiftly. There was just then no world for him outside of that old orchard with its falling blossoms and its shadows and its crooning winds. Once, when he told her the story of some college pranks wherein the endless feuds of freshmen and sophomores figured, she clapped her hands together according to her habit and laughed aloud, a clear, musical, silvery peal. It fell on Eric's ear with a shock of surprise. He thought it strange that she could laugh like that when she could not speak. Wherein lay the defect that closed for her the gates of speech? Was it possible that it could be removed? "Kilmeny," he said gravely after a moment's reflection, during which he had looked up as she sat with the ruddy sunlight falling through the lilac branches on her bare, silky head like a shower of red jewels, "do you mind if I ask you something about your inability to speak? Will it hurt you to talk of the matter with me?" She shook her head. "Oh no," she wrote, "I do not mind at all. Of course I am sorry I cannot speak, but I am quite used to the thought, and it never hurts me at all." "Then, Kilmeny, tell me this. Do you know why it is that you are unable to speak, when all your other faculties are so perfect?" "No, I do not know at all why I cannot speak. I asked mother once, and she told me it was a judgment on her for a great sin she had committed, and she looked so strangely that I was frightened, and I never spoke of it to her or anyone else again." "Were you ever taken to a doctor to have your tongue and organs of speech examined?" "No. I remember when I was a very little girl that Uncle Thomas wanted to take me to a doctor in Charlottetown and see if anything could be done for me, but mother would not let him. She said it would be no use, and I do not think Uncle Thomas thought it would be, either." "You can laugh very naturally. Can you make any other sound?" "Yes, sometimes. When I am pleased or frightened, I have made little cries. But it is only when I am not thinking of it at all that I can do that. If I try to make a sound, I cannot do it at all." This seemed to Eric more mysterious than ever. "Do you ever try to speak, to utter words?" he persisted. "Oh yes, very often. All the time I am saying the words in my head, just as I hear other people saying them, but I never can make my tongue say them. Do not look so sorry, my friend. I am very happy, and I do not mind so very much not being able to speak. Only sometimes, when I have so many thoughts, and it seems so slow to write them out, some of them get away from me. I must play to you again. You look too sober." She laughed again, picked up her violin, and played a tinkling, roguish little melody, as if she were trying to tease him, looking at Eric over her violin with luminous eyes that dared him to be merry. Eric smiled, but the puzzled look returned to his face many times that evening. He walked home in a brown study. Kilmeny's case certainly seemed a strange one, and the more he thought of it, the stranger it seemed. "It strikes me as something very peculiar that she should be able to make sounds only when she is not thinking about it," he reflected. "I wish David Baker could examine her, but I suppose that is out of the question. That grim pair who have charge of her would never consent." End of chapter 8.
Chapter 9 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. Read by Chloe Winters, February 2008. Chapter 9. The Straight Simplicity of Eve. For the next 3 weeks, Eric Marshall seemed to himself to be living two lives, as distinct from each other as if he possessed a double personality. In one, he taught the Lindsay District School diligently and painstakingly, solved problems, argued on theology with Robert Williamson, called at the homes of his pupils and took tea in state with their parents, went to a rustic dance or two and played havoc, all unwittingly, with the hearts of the Lindsay maidens. But this life was a dream of workaday, He only lived in the other, which was spent in an old orchard, grassy and overgrown, where the minutes seemed to lag for sheer love of the spot, and the June winds made wild harping in the old spruces. Here, every evening he met Kilmeny. In that old orchard they garnered hours of quiet happiness together. Together they went wandering in the fair fields of old romance. Together they read many books and talked of many things. And, when they were tired of all else, Kilmeny played to him, and the old orchard echoed with her lovely, fantastic melodies. At every meeting her beauty came home afresh to him, with the old thrill of glad surprise. In the intervals of absence, it seemed to him that she could not possibly be as beautiful as he remembered her, and then when they met, she seemed even more so. He learned to watch for the undisguised light of welcome that always leaped into her eyes at the sound of his footsteps. She was nearly always there before him, and she always showed that she was glad to see him, with the frank delight of a child watching for a dear comrade. She was never in the same mood twice. Now she was grave, now gay, now stately, now pensive, but she was always charming. Thrawn and twisted the old Gordon stock might be, but it had at least this one offshoot of perfect grace and symmetry. Her mind and heart, utterly unspoiled of the world, were as beautiful as her face. All the ugliness of existence had passed her by, shrined in her double solitude of upbringing and muteness. She was naturally quick and clever. Delightful little flashes of wit and humor sparkled out occasionally. She could be whimsical, even charmingly capricious. Sometimes innocent mischief glimmered out of the unfathomable deeps of her blue eyes. Sarcasm, even, was not unknown to her. Now and then she punctured some harmless bubble of a young man's conceit or masculine superiority with a biting little line of daintily written script. She assimilated the ideas in the books they read, speedily, eagerly, and thoroughly, always seizing on the best and truest, and rejecting the false and spurious and weak with an unfailing intuition at which Eric marveled. Hers was the spear of Ithuriel, trying out the dross of everything and leaving only the pure gold. In manner and outlook she was still a child, yet now and again she was as old as Eve. An expression would leap into her laughing face, a subtle meaning reveal itself in her smile that held all the lore of womanhood and all the wisdom of the ages. Her way of smiling enchanted him. The smile always began far down in her eyes and flowed outward to her face like a sparkling brook stealing out of shadow into sunshine. He knew everything about her life. She told him her simple history freely. She often mentioned her uncle and aunt and seemed to regard them with deep affection. She rarely spoke of her mother. Eric came somehow to understand, less from what she said than from what she did not say, that Kilmeny, though she had loved her mother, had always been rather afraid of her. There had not been between them the natural, beautiful confidence of mother and child. Of Neil she wrote frequently at first, and seemed very fond of him. Later she ceased to mention him, perhaps, for she was marvelously quick to catch and interpret every fleeting change of expression in his voice and face. She discerned what Eric did not know himself, that his eyes clouded and grew moody at the mention of Neil's name. Once she asked him naively, "Are there many people like you out in the world?"
"Thousands of them," said Eric, laughing.
She looked gravely at him, then she gave her head a quick, decided little shake. "I do not think so," she wrote. "I do not know much of the world, but I do not think there are many people like you in it." One evening, when the faraway hills and fields were scarved in gauzy purples and the intervals were brimming with golden mists, Eric carried to the old orchard a little limp, worn volume that held a love story. It was the first thing of the kind he had ever read to her, for in the first novel he had lent her, the love interest had been very slight and subordinate. This was a beautiful, passionate idyll, exquisitely told. He read it to her, lying in the grass at her feet. She listened with her hands clasped over her knee and her eyes cast down. It was not a long story, and when he had finished it, he shut the book and looked up at her questioningly. "Do you like it, Kilmeny?" he asked. Very slowly, she took her slate and wrote, "Yes, I like it. But it hurt me, too. I did not know that a person could like anything that hurt her. I do not know why it hurt me. I felt as if I had lost something that I never had. That was a very silly feeling, was it not? But I did not understand the book very well, you see. It is about love, and I do not know anything about love. Mother told me once that love is a curse, and that I must pray that it would never enter into my life. She said it very earnestly, and so I believed her. But your book teaches that it is a blessing. It says that it is the most splendid and wonderful thing in life. Which am I to believe?"
"Love, real love, is never a curse, Kilmeny," said Eric gravely. "There is a false love which is a curse. Perhaps your mother believed it was that which had entered her life and ruined it, and so she made the mistake. There is nothing in the world, or in heaven either, as I believe, so truly beautiful and wonderful and blessed as love." "Have you ever loved?" asked Kilmeny, with the directness of phrasing necessitated by her mode of communication, which was sometimes a little terrible. She asked the question simply and without any embarrassment. She knew of no reason why love might not be discussed with Eric, as other matters, music and books and travels, might be.
"No," said Eric, honestly as he thought. "But everyone has an ideal of love whom he hopes to meet some day, the ideal woman of a young man's dream. I suppose I have mine in some sealed secret chamber of my heart."
"I suppose your ideal woman would be beautiful, like the woman in your book?"
"Oh, yes. I am sure I could never care for an ugly woman," said Eric, laughing a little as he sat up. "Our ideals are always beautiful, whether they so translate themselves into realities or not. But the sun is going down. Time does certainly fly in this enchanted orchard. I believe you bewitch the moments away, Kilmeny. Your namesake of the poem was a somewhat uncanny maid, if I recollect aright, and thought as little of 7 years in Elfland as ordinary folk do of half an hour on Upper Earth. Some day I shall waken from a supposed hour's lingering here and find myself an old man with white hair and ragged coat, as in that fairy tale we read the other night. Will you let me give you this book? I should never commit the sacrilege of reading it in any other place than this. It is an old book, Kilmeny, a new book, savouring of the shop and marketplace, however beautiful it might be, would not do for you. This was one of my mother's books. She read it and loved it. See, the faded rose leaves she placed in it one day are still there. I'll write your name in it, that quaint, pretty name of yours, which always sounds as if it had been specially invented for you, Kilmeny of the Orchard, and the date of this perfect June day on which we read it together. Then, when you look at it, you will always remember me, and the white buds opening on that rose bush beside you, and the rush and murmur of the wind in the tops of those old spruces." He held out the book to her, but, to his surprise, she shook her head with a deeper flush on her face. "Won't you take the book, Kilmeny?"
"Why not?" She took her pencil and wrote slowly, unlike her usual quick movement. "Do not be offended with me. I shall not need anything to make me remember you, because I can never forget you. But I would rather not take the book. I do not want to read it again. It is about love, and there is no use in my learning about love, even if it is all you say. Nobody will ever love me. I'm too ugly."
"You? Ugly?" exclaimed Eric.
He was on the point of going off into a peal of laughter at the idea, when a glimpse of her half-averted face sobered him. On it was a hurt, bitter look, such as he remembered seeing once before, when he had asked her if she would not like to see the world for herself.
"Kilmeny," he said in astonishment, "you don't really think yourself ugly, do you?"
She nodded, without looking at him, and then wrote, "Oh, yes, I know that I am. I have known it for a long time. Mother told me that I was very ugly, and that nobody would ever like to look at me. I am sorry. It hurts me much worse to know I am ugly than it does to know I cannot speak. I suppose you will think that is very foolish of me, but it is true. That is why I did not come back to the orchard for such a long time, even after I had got over my fright. I hated to think that you would think me ugly. And that is why I do not want to go out into the world and meet people. They would look at me as the egg peddler did one day when I went out with Aunt Janet to his wagon the spring after Mother died. He stared at me so. I knew it was because he thought me so ugly, and I have always hidden when he came ever since." Eric's lips twitched. In spite of his pity for the real suffering displayed in her eyes, he could not help feeling amused over the absurd idea of this beautiful girl believing herself in all seriousness to be ugly.
"But, Kilmeny, do you think yourself ugly when you look in a mirror?" he asked, smiling.
"I have never looked in a mirror," she wrote. "I never knew there was such a thing until after Mother died and I read about it in a book. Then I asked Aunt Janet, and she said Mother had broken all the looking-glasses in the house when I was a baby. But I have seen my face reflected in the spoons, and in a little silver sugar bowl Aunt Janet has, and it is ugly, very ugly." Eric's face went down into the grass. For his life he could not help laughing, and for his life he would not let Kilmeny see him laughing. A certain little whimsical wish took possession of him, and he did not hasten to tell her the truth, as had been his first impulse. Instead, when he dared to look up, he said slowly,
"I don't think you are ugly, Kilmeny."
"Oh, but I'm sure you must," she wrote protestingly. Even Neil does. He tells me I am kind and nice, but one day I asked him if he thought me very ugly, and he looked away and would not speak, so I knew what he thought about it, too. Do not let us speak of this again. It makes me feel sorry and spoils everything. I forget it at other times. Let me play you some goodbye music, and do not feel vexed because I would not take your book. It would only make me unhappy to read it.
I am not vexed, said Eric, and I think you will take it some day yet, after I have shown you something I want you to see. Never mind your looks, Kilmeny. Beauty isn't everything.
Oh, it is a great deal, she wrote naively. But you do like me, even though I am so ugly, don't you? You like me because of my beautiful music, don't you?
I like you very much, Kilmeny, answered Eric, laughing a little, but there was in his voice a tender note of which he was unconscious. Kilmeny was aware of it, however, and she picked up her violin with a pleased smile. He left her playing there, and all the way through the dim, resinous spruce wood her music followed him like an invisible guardian spirit. "Kilmeny the beautiful," he murmured. "And yet, good heavens, the child thinks she is ugly. She with a face more lovely than ever an artist dreamed of. A girl of 18 who has never looked in a mirror. I wonder if there is another such in any civilized country in the world. What could have possessed her mother to tell her such a falsehood? I wonder if Margaret Gordon could have been quite sane. It is strange that Neil has never told her the truth. Perhaps he doesn't want her to find out." Eric had met Neil Gordon a few evenings before this, at a country dance where Neil had played the violin for the dancers. Influenced by curiosity, he had sought the lad's acquaintance. Neil was friendly and talkative at first, but at the first hint concerning the Gordons which Eric threw out skillfully, his face and manner changed. He looked secretive and suspicious, almost sinister. A sullen look crept into his big black eyes, and he drew his bow across the violin strings with a discordant screech, as if to terminate the conversation. Plainly nothing was to be found out from him about Kilmeny and her grim guardians. End of Chapter 9 of Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. Read by Chloe Winters, February 2008. Chapter 10 of Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. Chapter 10, A Troubling of the Waters. Read by Chloe Winters, February 2008. One evening in late June, Mrs. Williamson was sitting by her kitchen window. Her knitting lay unheeded in her lap, and Timothy, though he nestled ingratiatingly against her foot as he lay on the rug and purred his loudest, was unregarded. She rested her face on her hand and looked out of the window, across the distant harbor, with troubled eyes. "I guess I must speak," she thought wistfully. "I hate to do it. I always did hate meddling. My mother always used to say that 99 times out of 100, the last state of a meddler and them she meddled with was worse than the first. But I guess it's my duty. I was Margaret's friend, and it is my duty to protect her child any way I can. If the master does go back across there to meet her, I must tell him what I think about it." Overhead in his room, Eric was walking about whistling. Presently he came downstairs, thinking of the orchard and the girl who would be waiting for him there. As he crossed the little front entry, he heard Mrs. Williamson's voice calling to him. "Mr. Marshall, will you please come here a moment?" Mrs. Williamson looked at him deprecatingly. There was a flush on her faded cheek, and her voice trembled. "Mr. Marshall, I want to ask you a question. Perhaps you will think it isn't any of my business. But it isn't because I want to meddle. No, no, it is only because I think I ought to speak. I have thought it over for a long time, and it seems to me that I ought to speak. I hope you won't be angry, but even if you are, I must say what I have to say. Are you going back to the old Connor's orchard to meet Kilmeny Gordon?" For a moment an angry flush burned in Eric's face. It was more Mrs. Williamson's tone than her words which startled and annoyed him. "Yes, I am Mrs. Williamson," he said coldly. "What of it?" "Then, sir," said Mrs. Williamson with more firmness, "I have got to tell you that I don't think you are doing right. I have been suspecting all along that that was where you went every evening, but I haven't said a word to anyone about it. Even my husband doesn't know. But tell me this, master, does Kilmeny's uncle and aunt know that you are meeting her there?"
"Why," said Eric in some confusion, "I
do not know whether they do or not." But, Mrs. Williamson, surely you do not suspect me of meaning any harm or wrong to Kilmeny Gordon?
No, I don't, master. I might think it of some men, but never of you. I don't think for a minute that you would do her, or any other woman, any wilful wrong. But you may do her great harm for all that. I want you to stop and think about it. I guess you haven't thought. Kilmeny can't know anything about the world or about men, and she may get to thinking too much of you. That might break her heart, because you couldn't ever marry a dumb girl like her. So I don't think you ought to be meeting her so often in this fashion. It isn't right, master. Don't go to the orchard again.
Without a word, Eric turned away and went upstairs to his room. Mrs. Williamson picked up her knitting with a sigh.
"That's done, Timothy, and I'm real thankful," she said. "I guess there'll be no need of saying anything more. Mr. Marshall is a fine young man, only a little thoughtless. Now that he's got his eyes open, I'm sure he'll do what is right. I don't want Margaret's child made unhappy."
Her husband came to the kitchen door and sat down on the steps to enjoy his evening smoke, talking between whiffs to his wife of Elder Tracy's Church Row and Mary Alice Martin's beau, the price Jake Crosby was giving for eggs, the quantity of hay yielded by the hill meadow, the trouble he was having with old Molly's calf, and the respective merits of Plymouth Rock and Brahma Roosters. Mrs. Williamson answered at random and heard not one word in 10.
"What got the master, mother?" inquired old Robert presently. "I heard him striding up and down in his room, as if he was caged. So you didn't lock him in by mistake?"
"Maybe he's worried about the way Seth Tracy's acting in school," suggested Mrs. Williamson, who did not choose that her gossipy husband should suspect the truth about Eric and Kilmeny Gordon.
"He needn't worry a morsel over that. Seth'll quiet down as soon as he finds he can't run the master. He's a rare good teacher, better than Mr. West was, even, and that's saying something. The trustees are hoping he'll stay for another term. They're going to ask him at the school meeting tomorrow and offer him a raise of supplement."
Upstairs in his little room under the eaves, Eric Marshall was in the grip of the most intense and overwhelming emotion he had ever experienced. Up and down, to and fro, he walked, with set lips and clenched hands. When he was wearied out, he flung himself on a chair by the window and wrestled with the flood of feeling. Mrs. Williamson's words had torn away the delusive veil with which he had bound his eyes. He was face to face with the knowledge that he loved Kilmeny Gordon with the love that comes but once and is for all time. He wondered how he could have been so long blind to it. He knew that he must have loved her ever since their first meeting that May evening in the old orchard. And he knew that he must choose between two alternatives. Either he must never go to the orchard again, or he must go on as an avowed lover to woo him a wife. Worldly prudence, his inheritance from a long line of thrifty, cool-headed ancestors, was strong in Eric, and he did not yield easily or speedily to the dictates of his passion. All night he struggled against the new emotions that threatened to sweep away the common sense which David Baker had bade him take with him when he went a-wooing. Would not a marriage with Kilmeny Gordon be an unwise thing from any standpoint? Then something stronger and greater and more vital than wisdom or unwisdom rose up in him and mastered him. Kilmeny, beautiful, dumb Kilmeny, was, as he had once involuntarily thought, the one made for him. Nothing should part them. The mere idea of never seeing her again was so unbearable that he laughed at himself for having counted it a possible alternative. "If I can win Kilmeny's love, I shall ask her to be my wife," he said, looking out of the window to the dark southwestern hill beyond which lay his orchard. The velvet sky over it was still starry, but the water of the harbor was beginning to grow silvery in the reflection of the dawn that was breaking in the east. "Her misfortune will only make her dearer to me. I cannot realize that a month ago I did not know her. It seems to me that she has been a part of my life forever. I wonder if she was grieved that I did not go to the orchard last night, if she waited for me. I wonder if she cares for me. If she does, she does not know it herself yet. It will be my sweet task to teach her what love means, and no man has ever had a lovelier, purer pupil." At the annual school meeting the next afternoon, the trustees asked Eric to take the Lindsay School for the following year. He consented unhesitatingly. That evening he went to Mrs. Williamson as she washed her tea dishes in the kitchen. "Mrs. Williamson, I'm going back to the old Connors orchard to see Kilmeny again tonight." She looked at him reproachfully. "Well, master, I have no more to say. I suppose it wouldn't be of any use if I had, but you know what I think of it."
"I intend to marry Kilmeny Gordon if I can win her."
An expression of amazement came into the good woman's face. She looked scrutinizingly at the firm mouth and steady gray eyes for a moment. Then she said in a troubled voice, "Do you think that is wise, master? I suppose Kilmeny is pretty.
The egg peddler told me she was, and no doubt she is a good, nice girl. But she wouldn't be a suitable wife for you, a girl that can't speak.
That doesn't make any difference to me.
But what will your people say?
I have no people except my father. When he sees Kilmeny, he will understand. She is all the world to me, Mrs. Williamson.
As long as you believe that, there is nothing more to be said, was the quiet answer. I'd be a little bit afraid if I was you, though. But young people never think of those things.
My only fear is that she won't care for me, said Eric soberly.
Mrs. Williamson surveyed the handsome, broad-shouldered young man shrewdly.
I don't think there are many women who would say you know, Master. I wish you well in your wooing, though I can't help thinking you're doing a daft-like thing. I hope you won't have any trouble with Thomas and Janet. They are so different from other folks there is no knowing. But take my advice, Master, and go and see them about it right off. Don't go a-meeting Kilmeny unbeknownst to them.
I shall certainly take your advice, said Eric gravely. I should have gone to them before. It was merely thoughtlessness on my part. Possibly they do know already. Kilmeny may have told them.
Mrs. Williamson shook her head decidedly.
No, no, Master, she hasn't. They'd never have let her go on meeting you there if they had known. I know them too well to think of that for a moment. Go you straight to them, and say to them just what you have said to me. That is your best plan, Master. And take care of Neil. People say he has a notion of Kilmeny himself. He'll do you a bad turn if he can, I've no doubt. Them foreigners can't be trusted, and he's just as much a foreigner as his parents before him, though he has been brought up on oatmeal and the shorter catechism, as the old saying has it. I feel that somehow. I always feel it when I look at him singing in the choir.
Oh, I'm not afraid of Neil, said Eric carelessly. He couldn't help loving Kilmeny. Nobody could.
I suppose every young man thinks that about his girl, if he's the right sort of young man, said Mrs. Williamson with a little sigh. She watched Eric out of sight anxiously.
I hope it'll all come out all right, she thought.
I hope he ain't making an awful mistake, but I'm afraid. Kilmeny must be very pretty to have bewitched him so. Well, I suppose there is no use in my worrying over it. But I do wish he'd never gone back to that old orchard and seen her.
End of Chapter 10 of Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. Read by Chloe Winters, February 2008. Chapter 11 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. Chapter 11, A Lover and His Lass. Read by Chloe Winters, February 2008. Kilmeny was in the orchard when Eric reached it, and he lingered for a moment in the shadow of the spruce wood to dream over her beauty. The orchard had lately overflowed in waves of old-fashioned caraway, and she was standing in the midst of its sea of bloom, with the lace-like blossoms swaying around her in the wind. She wore the simple dress of pale blue print in which he had first seen her. Silk attire could not better have become her loveliness. She had woven herself a chaplet of half-open white rosebuds and placed it on her dark hair, where the delicate blossoms seemed less wonderful than her face. When Eric stepped through the gap, she ran to meet him with outstretched hands, smiling. He took her hands and looked into her eyes with an expression before which hers, for the first time, faltered. She looked down, and a warm blush stained the ivory curves of her cheek and throat. His heart bounded, for in that blush he recognized the banner of love's vanguard. "Are you glad to see me, Kilmeny?" he asked in a low, significant tone. She nodded, and wrote in a somewhat embarrassed fashion, "Yes, why do you ask? You know I am always glad to see you. I was afraid you would not come. You did not come last night, and I was so sorry. Nothing in the orchard seemed nice any longer. I couldn't even play. I tried to, and my violin only cried. I waited until it was dark, and then I went home. I'm sorry you were disappointed, Kilmeny. I couldn't come last night. Some day I shall tell you why. I stayed home to learn a new lesson. I am sorry you missed me. No, I'm glad. Can you understand how a person may be glad and sorry for the same thing?" She nodded again, with a return of her usual sweet composure. "Yes, I could not have understood once, but I can now. Did you learn your new lesson?"
"Yes, very thoroughly. It was a delightful lesson when I once understood it. I must try to teach it to you some day. Come over to the old bench, Kilmeny. There is something I want to say to you. But first, will you give me a rose?" She ran to the bush and, after careful deliberation, selected a perfect half-open bud and brought it to him, a white bud with a faint sunrise flush about its golden heart.
"Thank you. It is as beautiful as a woman I know," Eric said.
A wistful look came into her face at his words, and she walked with a drooping head across the orchard to the bench.
"Kilmeny," he said seriously, "I'm going to ask you to do something for me. I want you to take me home with you and introduce me to your uncle and aunt."
She lifted her head and stared at him incredulously, as if he had asked her to do something wildly impossible. Understanding from his grave face that he meant what he said, a look of dismay dawned in her eyes. She shook her head almost violently and seemed to be making a passionate, instinctive effort to speak. Then she caught up her pencil and wrote with feverish haste, "I cannot do that. Do not ask me to. You do not understand. They would be very angry. They do not want to see anyone coming to the house, and they would never let me come here again. Oh, you do not mean it." He pitied her for the pain and bewilderment in her eyes, but he took her slender hands in his and said firmly, "Yes, Kilmeny, I do mean it. It is not quite right for us to be meeting each other here as we have been doing, without the knowledge and consent of your friends. You cannot now understand this, but, believe me, it is so." She looked questioningly, pityingly into his eyes. What she read there seemed to convince her, for she turned very pale and an expression of hopelessness came into her face. Releasing her hands, she wrote slowly, "If you say it is wrong, I must believe it. I did not know anything so pleasant could be wrong. But if it is wrong, we must not meet here any more. Mother told me I must never do anything that was wrong, but I did not know this was wrong."
"It was not wrong for you, Kilmeny, but it was a little wrong for me, because I knew better, or rather should have known better. I didn't stop to think, as the children say. Some day you will understand fully. Now, you will take me to your uncle and aunt, and after I have said to them what I want to say, it will be all right for us to meet here or anywhere." She shook her head.
"No," she wrote. "Uncle Thomas and Aunt Janet will tell you to go away and never come back, and they will never let me come here any more. Since it is not right to meet you, I will not come. But it is no use to think of going to them. I did not tell them about you because I knew that they would forbid me to see you, but I am sorry, since it is so wrong."
"You must take me to them," said Eric firmly. "I am quite sure that things will not be as you fear when they hear what I have to say."
Uncomforted, she wrote forlornly, "I must do it, since you insist. But I am sure it will be no use. I cannot take you tonight because they are away. They went to the store at Radnor. But I will take you tomorrow night, and after that I shall not see you any more." Two great tears brimmed over in her big blue eyes and splashed down on her slate. Her lips quivered like a hurt child's. Eric put his arm impulsively about her and drew her head down upon his shoulder. As she cried there, softly, miserably, he pressed his lips to the silky black hair with its coronal of rosebuds. He did not see two burning eyes which were looking at him over the old fence, behind him, with hatred and mad passion blazing in their depths. Neil Gordon was crouched there, with clenched hands and heaving breast, watching them.
"Kilmeny, dear, don't cry," said Eric tenderly.
"You shall see me again, I promise you that, whatever happens. I do not think your uncle and aunt will be as unreasonable as you fear, but even if they are, they shall not prevent me from meeting you somehow." Kilmeny lifted her head and wiped the tears from her eyes. "You do not know what they are like," she wrote. "They will lock me into my room. That is the way they always punished me when I was a little girl. And once, not so very long ago, when I was a big girl, they did it."
"If they do, I'll get you out somehow," said Eric, laughing a little.
She allowed herself to smile, but it was a rather forlorn little effort. She did not cry any more, but her spirits did not come back to her. Eric talked gaily, but she only listened in a pensive, absent way, as if she scarcely heard him. When he asked her to play, she shook her head. "I cannot think any music tonight," she wrote. "I must go home, for my head aches and I feel very stupid."
"Very well, Kilmeny. Now, don't worry, little girl. It will all come out all right."
Evidently she did not share his confidence, for her head drooped again as they walked together across the orchard. At the entrance of the wild cherry lane, she paused and looked at him half reproachfully, her eyes filling again. She seemed to be bidding him a mute farewell. With an impulse of tenderness which he could not control, Eric put his arm around her and kissed her red, trembling mouth. She started back with a little cry. A burning color swept over her face, and the next moment she fled swiftly up the darkening lane. The sweetness of that involuntary kiss clung to Eric's lips as he went homeward, half intoxicating him. He knew that it had opened the gates of womanhood to Kilmeny. Never again, he felt, would her eyes meet his with their old unclouded frankness. When next he looked into them, he knew that he should see there the consciousness of his kiss. Behind her, in the orchard that night, Kilmeny had left her childhood. End of Chapter 11 of Kilmeny of the Orchard by L. M. Montgomery. Read by Chloe Winters, February 2008.
Chapter 12 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joan Freeman. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 12. A Prisoner of Love. When Eric betook himself to the orchard the next evening, he had to admit that he felt rather nervous. He did not know how the Gordons would receive him, and certainly the reports he had heard of them were not encouraging, to say the least of it. Even Mrs. Williamson, when he had told her where he was going, seemed to look upon him as one bent on bearding a lion in his den. "I do hope they won't be very uncivil to you, master," was the best she could say. He expected Kilmeny to be in the orchard before him, for he had been delayed by a call from one of the trustees. But she was nowhere to be seen. He walked across it to the wild cherry lane, but at its entrance he stopped short in sudden dismay. Neil Gordon had stepped from behind the trees and stood confronting him with blazing eyes and lips which writhed in emotion so great that at first it prevented him from speaking. With a thrill of dismay, Eric instantly understood what must have taken place. Neil had discovered that he and Kilmeny had been meeting in the orchard, and beyond doubt had carried that tale to Janet and Thomas Gordon. He realized how unfortunate it was that this should have happened before he had had time to make his own explanation. It would probably prejudice Kilmeny's guardians still further against him. At this point in his thoughts, Neil's pent-up passion suddenly found vent in a burst of wild words. "So you've come to meet her again. But she isn't here. You'll never see her again. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you." His voice rose to a shrill scream. He took a furious step nearer Eric as if he would attack him. Eric looked steadily in his eyes with a calm defiance, before which his wild passion broke like foam on a rock. "So you have been making trouble for Kilmeny, Neil, have you?" said Eric contemptuously. "I suppose you have been playing the spy, and I suppose that you have told her uncle and aunt that she has been meeting me here. Well, you have saved me the trouble of doing it, that is all. I was going to tell them myself tonight. I don't know what your motive in doing this has been. Was it jealousy of me? Or have you done it out of malice to Kilmeny?" His contempt cowed Neil more effectually than any display of anger could have done. "Never you mind why I did it," he muttered sullenly. "What I did or why I did it is no business of yours. And you have no business to come sneaking around here either. Kilmeny won't meet you here again." "She will meet me in her own home, then," said Eric sternly. "Neil, in behaving as you have done, you have shown yourself to be a very foolish, undisciplined boy. I am going straightway to Kilmeny's uncle and aunt to explain everything." Neil sprang forward in his path. "No, no, go away," he implored wildly. "Oh, sir, oh, Mr. Marshall, please go away. I'll do anything for you if you will. I love Kilmeny. I've loved her all my life. I'd give my life for her. I can't have you coming here to steal her from me. If you do, I'll kill you. I wanted to kill you last night when I saw you kiss her. Oh, yes, I saw you. I was watching, spying, if you like. I don't care what you call it. I had followed her. I suspected something. She was so different, so changed. She never would wear the flowers I picked for her any more. She seemed to forget I was there. I knew something had come between us, and it was you, curse you. Oh, I'll make you sorry for it." He was working himself up into a fury again, the untamed fury of the Italian peasant thwarted in his heart's desire. It overrode all the restraint of his training and environment. Eric, amid all his anger and annoyance, felt a thrill of pity for him. Neil Gordon was only a boy still, and he was miserable and beside himself. "Neil, listen to me," he said quietly. "You are talking very foolishly. It is not for you to say who shall or shall not be Kilmeny's friend. Now, you may just as well control yourself and go home like a decent fellow. I am not at all frightened by your threats, and I shall know how to deal with you if you persist in interfering with me or persecuting Kilmeny. I'm not the sort of person to put up with that, my lad." The restrained power in his tone and look cowed Neil. The latter turned sullenly away with another muttered curse and plunged into the shadow of the firs. Eric, not a little ruffled under all his external composure by this most unexpected and unpleasant encounter, pursued his way along the lane which wound on by the belt of woodland in twist and curve to the Gordon homestead. His heart beat as he thought of Kilmeny. What might she not be suffering? Doubtless Neil had given a very exaggerated and distorted account of what he had seen, and probably her dour relations were very angry with her, poor child. Anxious to avert their wrath as soon as might be, he hurried on, almost forgetting his meeting with Neil. The threats of the latter did not trouble him at all. He thought the angry outburst of a jealous boy mattered but little. What did matter was that Kilmeny was in trouble, which his heedlessness had brought upon her. Presently he found himself before the Gordon house. It was an old building with sharp eaves and dormer windows, its shingles stained a dark gray by long exposure to wind and weather. Faded green shutters hung on the windows of the lower story. Behind it grew a thick wood of spruces. The little yard in front of it was grassy and prim and flowerless, but over the low front door a luxuriant, early-flowering rose vine clambered, in a riot of blood-red blossom which contrasted strangely with the general bareness of its surroundings. It seemed to fling itself over the grim old house as if intent on bombarding it with an alien life and joyousness. Eric knocked at the door, wondering if it might be possible that Kilmeny should come to it. But a moment later it was opened by an elderly woman, a woman of rigid lines from the hem of her lank, dark print dress to the crown of her head, covered with black hair which, despite its few gray threads, was still thick and luxuriant. She had a long, pale face, somewhat worn and wrinkled, but possessing a certain harsh comeliness of feature, which neither age nor wrinkles had quite destroyed. And her deep-set, light-gray eyes were not devoid of suggested kindliness, although they now surveyed Eric with an unconcealed hostility. Her figure, in its merciless dress, was very angular, yet there was about her a dignity of carriage and manner which Eric liked. In any case, he preferred her unsmiling dourness to vulgar garrulity. He lifted his hat. "Have I the honor of speaking to Miss Gordon?" he asked. "I am Janet Gordon," said the woman stiffly. "Then I wish to talk with you and your brother." "Come in." She stepped aside and motioned him to a low brown door opening on the right. "Go in and sit down. I'll call Thomas," she said coldly as she walked out through the hall. Eric walked into the parlor and sat down as bidden. He found himself in the most old-fashioned room he had ever seen. The solidly made chairs and tables, of some wood grown dark and polished with age, made even Mrs. Williamson's parlor set of horsehair seem extravagantly modern by contrast. The painted floor was covered with round braided rugs. On the center table was a lamp, a Bible, and some theological volumes contemporary with the square-runged furniture. The walls, wainscoted halfway up in wood and covered for the rest with a dark diamond-patterned paper, were hung with faded engravings, mostly of clerical-looking, bewigged parsonages in gowns and bands. but over the high, undecorated black mantelpiece, in a ruddy glow of sunset light striking through the window, hung one which caught and held Eric's attention to the exclusion of everything else. It was the enlarged crayon photograph of a young girl, and in spite of the crudity of execution, it was easily the center of interest in the room. Eric at once guessed that this must be the picture of Margaret Gordon, for although quite unlike Kilmeny's sensitive, spirited face in general, there was a subtle, unmistakable resemblance about brow and chin. The pictured face was a very handsome one, suggestive of velvety dark eyes and vivid coloring, but it was its expression rather than its beauty which fascinated Eric. Never had he seen a countenance indicative of a more intense and stubborn willpower. Margaret Gordon was dead and buried. The picture was a cheap and inartistic production in an impossible frame of gilt and plush. Yet the vitality in that face dominated its surroundings still. What, then, must have been the power of such a personality in life? Eric realized that this woman could and would have done whatsoever she willed, unflinchingly and unrelentingly. She could stamp her desire on everything and everybody about her, molding them to her wish and will, in their own despite and in defiance of all the resistance they might make. Many things in Kilmeny's upbringing and temperament became clear to him. "If that woman had told me I was ugly, I should have believed her," he thought. "I, even though I had a mirror to contradict her, I should never have dreamed of disputing or questioning anything she might have said. The strange power in her face is almost uncanny, peering out as it does from a mask of beauty and youthful curves. Pride and stubbornness are its salient characteristics. Well, Kilmeny does not at all resemble her mother in expression, and only very slightly in feature." His reflections were interrupted by the entrance of Thomas and Janet Gordon. The latter had evidently been called from his work. He nodded without speaking, and the two sat gravely down before Eric. "I have come to see you with regard to your niece, Mr. Gordon," he said abruptly, realizing that there would be small use in beating about the bush with this grim pair. I met Neil Gordon in the Connors' orchard, and I found that he has told you that I have been meeting Kilmeny there." He paused. Thomas Gordon nodded again, but he did not speak, and he did not remove his steady, piercing eyes from the young man's flushed countenance. Janet still sat in a sort of expectant immovability. "I fear that you have formed an unfavorable opinion of me on this account, Mr. Gordon," Eric went on, "but I hardly think I deserve it. I can explain the matter if you will allow me. I met your niece accidentally in the orchard 3 weeks ago and heard her play. I thought her music very wonderful, and I fell into the habit of coming to the orchard in the evenings to hear it. I had no thought of harming her in any way, Mr. Gordon. I thought of her as a mere child, and a child who was doubly sacred because of her affliction. But recently it occurred to me that I was not behaving quite honorably in encouraging her to meet me thus. Yesterday evening I asked her to bring me here and introduce me to you and her aunt. We would have come then if you had been at home. As you were not, we arranged to come tonight. I hope you will not refuse me the privilege of seeing your niece, Mr. Gordon," said Eric eagerly. "I ask you to allow me to visit her here, but I do not ask you to receive me as a friend on my own recommendations only. I will give you references, men of standing in Charlottetown and Queensley. If you refer to them..." "I do not need to do that," said Thomas Gordon quietly. "I know more of you than you think, master. I know your father well by reputation, and I have seen him. I know you are a rich man's son, whatever your whim in teaching a country school may be. Since you have kept your own counsel about your affairs, I supposed you didn't want your true position generally known, and so I have held my tongue about you. I know no ill of you, master, and I think none, now that I believe you were not beguiling Kilmeny to meet you unknown to her friends of set purpose. But all this doesn't make you a suitable friend for her, sir. It makes you all the more unsuitable. The less she sees of you, the better." Eric almost started to his feet in an indignant protest, but he swiftly remembered that his only hope of winning Kilmeny lay in bringing Thomas Gordon to another way of thinking. He had got on better than he had expected so far. He must not now jeopardize what he had gained by rashness or impatience. "Why do you think so, Mr. Gordon?" he asked, regaining his self-control with an effort. "Well, plain speaking is best, master. If you were to come here and see Kilmeny often, she'd most likely come to think too much of you. I mistrust there's some mischief done in that direction already. Then, when you went away, she might break her heart, for she is one of those who feel things deeply. She has been happy enough. I know folks condemn us for the way she has been brought up, but they don't know everything. It was the best way for her, all things considered. And we don't want her made unhappy, master." "But I love your niece, and I want to marry her if I can win her love," said Eric steadily. He surprised them out of their self-possession at last. Both started and looked at him as if they could not believe the evidence of their ears. "Marry her? Marry Kilmeny!" exclaimed Thomas Gordon incredulously. "You can't mean it, sir. Why, she is dumb. Kilmeny is dumb." "That makes no difference in my love for her, although I deeply regret it for her own sake," answered Eric. "I can only repeat what I have already said, Mr. Gordon. I want Kilmeny for my wife." The older man leaned forward and looked at the floor in a troubled fashion, drawing his bushy eyebrows down and tapping the calloused tips of his fingers together uneasily. He was evidently puzzled by this unexpected turn of the conversation, and in grave doubt what to say. "What would your father say to all this, master?" he queried at last. "I have often heard my father say that a man must marry to please himself," said Eric with a smile. "If he felt tempted to go back on that opinion, I think the sight of Kilmeny would convert him. But after all, it is what I say that matters in this case, isn't it, Mr. Gordon? I am well educated and not afraid of work. I can make a home for Kilmeny in a few years, even if I have to depend entirely on my own resources. Only give me the chance to win her. That is all I ask." "I don't think it would do, master," said Thomas Gordon, shaking his head. "Of course, I dare say you—" he tried to say love, but Scotch reserve balked stubbornly at the terrible word. "You think you like Kilmeny now, but you are only a lad, and lads' fancies change." "Mine will not," Eric broke in vehemently. "It is not a fancy, Mr. Gordon. It is the love that comes once in a lifetime, and once only. I may be but a lad, but I know that Kilmeny is the one woman in the world for me. There can never be any other. Oh, I'm not speaking rashly or inconsiderately. I have weighed the matter well and looked at it from every aspect. And it all comes to this. I love Kilmeny, and I want what any decent man who loves a woman truly has the right to have, the chance to win her love in return." "Well," Thomas Gordon drew a long breath that was almost a sigh. "Maybe, if you feel like that, master. I don't know. There are some things it isn't right to cross. Perhaps we oughtn't. Janet, woman, what shall we say to him?" Janet Gordon had hitherto spoken no word. She had sat rigidly upright on one of the old chairs under Margaret Gordon's insistent picture, with her knotted, toil-worn hands grasping the carved arms tightly, and her eyes fastened on Eric's face. At first their expression had been guarded and hostile, but as the conversation proceeded they lost this gradually and became almost kindly. Now, when her brother appealed to her, she leaned forward and said eagerly, "Do you know that there is a stain on Kilmeny's birth, master? I know that her mother was the innocent victim of a very sad mistake, Miss Gordon. I admit no real stain where there was no conscious wrongdoing. Though, for that matter, even if there were, it would be no fault of Kilmeny's, and would make no difference to me, as far as she is concerned." A sudden change swept over Janet Gordon's face, quite marvelous in the transformation it wrought. Her grim mouth softened, and a flood of repressed tenderness glorified her cold gray eyes. "Well, then," she said, almost triumphantly, "since neither that nor her dumbness seems to be any drawback in your eyes, I don't see why you should not have the chance you want. Perhaps your world will say she is not good enough for you, but she is. She is," this half defiantly. "She is a sweet and innocent and true-hearted lassie. She is bright and clever, and she is not ill-looking. Thomas, I say let the young man have his will." Thomas Gordon stood up as if he considered the responsibility off his shoulders and the interview at an end. "Very well, Janet, woman, since you think it is wise. And may God deal with him as he deals with her. Good evening, master. I'll see you again, and you are free to come and go as suits you. But I must go to my work now. I left my horses standing in the field." "I will go up and send Kilmeny down," said Janet quietly. She lighted the lamp on the table and left the room. A few minutes later Kilmeny came down. Eric rose and went to meet her eagerly, but she only put out her right hand with a pretty dignity, and while she looked into his face, she did not look into his eyes. "You see, I was right after all, Kilmeny," he said, smiling. "Your uncle and aunt haven't driven me away. On the contrary, they have been very kind to me, and they say I may see you whenever and wherever I like." She smiled and went over to the table to write on her slate. "But they were very angry last night and said dreadful things to me. I felt very frightened and unhappy. They seemed to think I had done something terribly wrong. Uncle Thomas said he would never trust me out of his sight again. I could hardly believe it when Aunt Janet came up and told me you were here and that I might come down. She looked at me very strangely as she spoke, but I could see that all the anger had gone out of her face. She seemed pleased and yet sad. But I am glad they have forgiven us." She did not tell him how glad she was, and how unhappy she had been over the thought that she was never to see him again. Yesterday she would have told him all frankly and fully, but for her yesterday was a lifetime away, a lifetime in which she had come into her heritage of womanly dignity and reserve. The kiss which Eric had left on her lips, the words her uncle and aunt had said to her, the tears she had shed for the first time on a sleepless pillow, all had conspired to reveal her to herself. She did not yet dream that she loved Eric Marshall, or that he loved her, but she was no longer the child to be made a dear comrade of. She was, though quite unconsciously, the woman to be wooed and won, exacting, with sweet, innate pride, her dues of allegiance. End of chapter 12.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.